after months of failed efforts to negotiate a ceasefire and hostage release deal in Gaza. Will the two sides agree to the latest offer on the table?
An Israeli proposal has been given to Hamas. It was done on Thursday night, our time. We're waiting for an official response from Hamas. We would note that publicly, Hamas officials came out and welcomed this proposal.
And Donald Trump weighs in on the possibility that he could go to jail following last week's criminal convictions.
I'm not sure the public would stand for it. I think it would be tough for the public to take. You know, at a certain point, there's a breaking point.
Plus, thousands of blue-eyed, noisy, singing insects emerge ready for mating after a decade or more underground. Today is Monday, June 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London. Families of hostages being held in Gaza demonstrated outside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office in Jerusalem on Sunday, urging him to accept a deal to end the war in Gaza that was presented by U.S. President Joe Biden on Friday. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby on ABC's This Week on Sunday said that if Hamas agrees to the deal, the U.S. expects Israel to also accept the plan.
This was an Israeli proposal. We have every expectation that if Hamas agrees to the proposal, as was transmitted to them, an Israeli proposal, that Israel would say yes. Again, well, all you get in a yes right now, George, and it's not a small thing, but what you get is the start of phase one. So you get some hostages coming out, initial hostages, you get some calm, you get some more humanitarian assistance, maybe up to 600 trucks, and then the two sides can start talking about phase two.
An aide to Netanyahu confirmed on Sunday that Israel had accepted a framework deal for winding down the Gaza war. Alex Cohen with Reuters has details.
In an interview with Britain's Sunday Times, Netanyahu's chief foreign policy advisor, Ophir Falk, said Biden's proposal was a deal we agreed to. It's not a good deal, but we dearly want the hostages released, all of them. Biden said the first phase entails a truce and the return of some hostages held by Hamas, after which the sides would negotiate on an open-ended cessation of hostilities for a second phase, in which remaining live captives would go free. Israel's defense minister Yoav Gallant said on Sunday that Israel would not accept Hamas continuing to rule Gaza at any stage during the process to wind down the war, and that it was examining alternatives to the Islamist group. Hamas has provisionally welcomed the Biden initiative, though a senior official from the group, Sami Abu Zuri, said on Sunday that Hamas is too big to be bypassed or sidelined by Netanyahu or Biden. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby told ABC News Sunday that if Hamas agrees to the deal to end the Gaza war, the U.S. expects Israel to also accept the plan. The war began October 7th when Hamas fighters stormed across the border fence into Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking more than 250 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. In the ensuing Israeli assault that has laid waste to much of the impoverished and besieged coastal enclave, more than 36,000 Palestinians have been killed, Gaza medical officials say. Israel says 290 of its troops have died in the fighting.
Alex Cohen with Reuters reporting. Former President Donald Trump weighed in on Sunday about the possibility of being sentenced to jail next month after his conviction for falsifying business records. The guilty verdict is already being used by both the Trump and Biden campaigns to fire up their respective supporters. But analysts say swaying undecided voters could be trickier. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias has details.
He may be the first U.S. president to be convicted on criminal charges, but Donald Trump's popularity isn't waning on the campaign trail, according to one of his lawyers.
The Trump campaign obviously smashed political fundraising records, including raising money from tens of thousands of new donors in the 24 hours after this verdict. I think the American people see this judgment for what it was, and we're certainly hopeful that on appeal we can get it thrown out.
During the trial, prosecutors argued Trump falsified business records to illegally influence the outcome of the 2016 election that he won. The guilty verdict won't help Trump politically, especially with African-American voters, says Maryland Governor Wes Moore, a Democrat.
What's going to resonate with the community as a whole is having a person, having a president like we have in President Biden, who's actually focusing on our futures.
In an exclusive interview that aired Sunday on Fox and Friends, Trump weighed in on the possibility of being sentenced to jail or house arrest on July 11th.
I don't know that the public would stand it, you know. I'm not sure the public would stand for it. I think it would be tough for the public to take. You know, at a certain point, there's a breaking point.
The Biden campaign posted a clip of the interview on X with the caption reading, quote, "Convicted felon Trump suggests there will be violence if he is put under house arrest." While U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to stick to his messaging that no one is above the law, his campaign could increasingly use Trump's guilty verdict to attack the presumptive Republican presidential nominee's character, says political scientist at the University of Chicago, Susan Stokes.
His desire to use his money and power and influence to avoid being held to account, you can expect that kind of focus from them.
Beyond catering to his base, the Trump campaign would do well to tweak their strategy to win other voters, Stokes added.
Maybe suburban women who might be a little bit on the fence about what to do in the 2024 in November and need to be given some reason to look past this verdict.
Both presidential candidates are expected to continue courting undecided voters this month in the lead up to the first presidential debate set for June 27th. Verónica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Just 4 days after his hush money conviction, Trump joined the video app TikTok. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
When Donald Trump was president, he once tried to ban the video sharing app TikTok. Now he's on it, joining Saturday and posting from a UFC fight. "It's an honor," Trump said in the TikTok video, which features footage of him waving to fans and posing for selfies. By Sunday morning, Trump had more than 1.1 million followers. The Biden-Harris campaign joined in February and has about 336,000 followers. In April, Biden signed legislation that could ban TikTok in the U.S. because of its Chinese ownership and security concerns. Trump said earlier this year that he still believes TikTok poses a national security risk, but was opposed to banning it. I'm Julie Walker.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Parachutists jumped from World War II era planes into now peaceful Normandy to kick off a week of ceremonies marking the 80th anniversary of D-Day. World leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, are among VIPs that France is expecting to mark the day Allied troops helped free Europe of Adolf Hitler's tyranny. Iran's hardline former president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad registered on Sunday to run for president in the country's June 28th election, organized after the death of Ibrahim Raisi in a helicopter crash last month. And a community of breast milk donors is formed in Uganda after women struggled with finding ways to keep their babies having health issues alive. The nonprofit is the only group outside a hospital setting in the country that conserves breast milk in substantial amounts. President Cyril Ramaphosa called on South Africa's political parties to work together for the good of the country, as Sunday's final results from last week's election confirmed his African National Congress had lost its majority for the first time. Angela Johnston with Reuters has the story.
It represents a victory for all the people of South Africa.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa praised the country's election process on Sunday. Even though his once dominant African National Congress party officially lost its majority for the first time ever.
We have held another successful election that has been free, fair, credible, and peaceful.
The ANC had its worst election showing since it came to power 30 years ago, ending white minority rule. It's Africa's oldest liberation movement, once led by Nelson Mandela. With South Africans angry over joblessness, inequality, and rolling blackouts, support for the party fell to 40.2%. from 57.5% in 2019. Official results showed the ANC won 159 seats in the 400-seat parliament, down from 230 in the previous assembly. That means it must now share power, likely with a major political rival, in order to keep it. It's an unprecedented prospect in South Africa's post-apartheid history. Parties now have 2 weeks to hash out a deal before a new parliament sits to choose a president. The president would likely still come from the ANC, as it remains the biggest force. Its poor showing has fueled speculation that Ramaphosa's days might be numbered, but the ANC has called that idea a no-go. The Democratic Alliance, or DA, is the main opposition party. It's white-led, pro-business, and received nearly 22% of the vote.
Thank you.
Leader John Steenhuisen said the party has appointed a negotiating team for coalition talks.
The purpose of these initial talks will be to gather information of what options are available to the DA as we seek to rescue South Africa from doomsday.
That doomsday, according to his party, would be a coalition between the ANC and far-left economic freedom fighters, which received 9.5% of the vote. Other competitors include MK, a new party led by former President Jacob Zuma, which took 14.6% of the vote. The prospect of the ANC teaming up with either of those two parties has rattled South Africa's business community and global investors, who would prefer a coalition that brings in the DA.
Angela Johnston with Reuters reporting. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. U.S. and Chinese defense officials offered competing visions for Asia, even as they agreed to keep channels open during the three-day Shangri-La Security Summit that wrapped up Sunday in Singapore, VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
This was Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin's first face-to-face meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Defense Minister Dong Jun. High-level talks that China had rejected until recently. Dong says, we have always been open to exchanges and cooperation, but this requires both sides to meet each other halfway. Some differences appeared irreconcilable at this summit, and Chinese officials went on the attack. Jing Jianfen is a Chinese lieutenant general. He says facts show that the U.S. is the biggest corrupter of the international order, the biggest obstacle to progress in global governance, and the greatest challenge to regional peace and stability. In his comments, Austin insisted war is avoidable and dialogue is necessary.
And every conversation is not going to be a happy conversation, but it is important that we continue to talk to each other.
There is much to talk about, including China's military threats against democratic Taiwan. And in the disputed South China Sea, Chinese ships have harassed much smaller Philippine vessels, raising concerns that the U.S.-Philippine defense treaty could be triggered. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is the Philippine president.
If a Filipino citizen is killed by a willful act, that is, I think, very, very close to what we define as an act of war. And therefore, we will respond accordingly.
Those hotspots make it even more important for the U.S. and China to keep talking, many regional analysts say. Lim Tai Wei is a professor at the National University of Singapore.
Temperatures are cooling down, although not under the illusion that the problems will be resolved, because these are complex problems. But the priority now is to tune down the temperature to create the right atmospheres for greater confidence-building measures as well as more dialogues. And outreach.
At least for now, China is agreeing to continue those meetings. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
Speaking at the Security Forum in Singapore, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused China of pressuring other countries not to attend upcoming Ukraine peace talks.
Disappointed that some world leaders have not yet confirmed their participation in the peace summit. Unfortunately, there are also attempts to disrupt the summit.
Meanwhile, Ukraine imposed emergency power shutdowns in most of the country on Sunday, a day after Russia unleashed large-scale attacks on energy infrastructure. A new Netflix series that's produced in India has put a historic red light district in Pakistan in the spotlight. Set in the eastern city of Lahore, Hiramandi, The Diamond Bazaar is one of the most popular non-English series on the streaming platform. But as VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman reports, not everyone is happy with the attention.
Nestled in the alleys of old Lahore is the Mughal-era Shahi Mohalla, or the Royal Neighborhood. In its heart lies Hiramandi, the historic red-light district of Pakistan's eastern metropolis. It's in the spotlight these days, thanks to the Netflix series Hiramandi, The Diamond Bazaar.
Sir, these tawaifs are very powerful.
The 8-part fictional drama by acclaimed Indian filmmaker Sanjay Leela Bhansali focuses on the role of courtesans in India's independence movement. A month since its May 1st release, Hiramandi remains in the top 10 most viewed non-English series on the streaming platform.
Camera crews are coming every day to film the streets, but these streets are nothing like what the series shows.
The streets where sunset long ago ushered the sound of women singing and dancing to entertain men now reverberate with the noise of motorbikes and rickshaws. Balconies where performers once waited for clients show glimpses of lost grandeur. Artisans at the few remaining music stores are barely getting by.
Business has reduced a lot. There are few singers and musicians. A lot of people are coming these days, but we don't talk to them. It's a waste of time.
A push to dismantle the red light district where performing arts and prostitution thrived in the shadow of a centuries-old Mughal-era mosque and fort came in the 1980s, during the rule of conservative military dictator Zia-ul-Haq. But Shagufta Begum chose to stay. She was only 12 when she started singing for crowds.
We used to practice in the morning. At night, the bazaar would be set up and we would go there to perform. In the era of Zia, it all shut down. He said, "This is not acceptable. Shut it down."
Arts died in the area decades ago and sex work diminished as well. But the rich culinary culture of old Lahore helped revive a lane as a food street. Shagufta Begum's son, Abrar Hussain, runs a popular restaurant on the roof of their home. He's working on a video series to preserve the area's history.
When this area was booming, people would hesitate to come here. It would hurt their dignity. But thanks to Sanjay Leela Bhansali, people are thinking about this area. TikTokers are coming to make videos. No one used to come before.
But Hussain's wife, Misbah, is not happy with the attention.
Our house is being highlighted. TikTokers are making videos. TV channels are asking strange, prying questions. I really don't like this.
Hiramandi was hardly as opulent as the neighborhood in the Netflix series. But many famous Pakistani actresses and singers once called it home. Shagufta Begum misses those times.
It should come back, but it won't. The religious lobby won't let it.
As night falls, customers come to enjoy the restaurants. As for those expecting to see a red light district as depicted on screen, Hiramandi only has stories to offer. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Lahore, Pakistan.
And finally today, it is an emergence that's been more than a decade in the making. Trillions of cicadas and broods that have been underground for 13 and 17 years are now emerging in parts of the Midwestern and Southern United States. And VOA's Dora McCore reports they are ready to mate.
After 13 to 17 years underground, periodical cicadas emerge once the ground temperature reaches about 17 degrees Celsius. Paula Shrewsbury is an entomologist at the University of Maryland.
They're like teenagers coming out of the ground, right? And they are ready to go, yeah.
Floyd Shockley is an entomologist at the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum.
The first thing that they have to do when they dig their way to the surface is they have to molt into the adult stage. So they come out as nymphs.
Two broods of cicadas emerge this year. One stays underground for 13 years, the other for 17. Why they remain down there for so long is a mystery, but it could be a reaction to radical temperature changes long ago. Again, Floyd Shockley.
the last few ice ages, which would have happened after Magus Cicada evolved, may have forced them to have longer life cycles in order to survive periods of time when their host trees would have been impacted by glaciers.
Once above ground, the cicadas only stay around 4 to 6 weeks. And this year, in two parts of the United States. Again, Paula Shrewsbury.
The southern states and the central U.S. is going to be hardest hit. They will have trillions of cicadas there.
After 4 or 5 days, the mating dance begins. The male cicadas gather in trees and start singing to attract the females, who make the final choice. Paula Shrewsbury explains.
She will flick her wings, and he will mate her. And once she's mated, he inserts what's called a copulatory plug, which plugs the female so that other males can't mate with her. But then he gets to go on and find other females to mate with.
Females almost immediately start cutting small slits into tree stems. They lay between 400 and 600 eggs before they die. Cicadas are a nutritious food source for animals and for humans. Chefs have come up with all sorts of ways to cook them, from the savory to the sweet. Floyd Shockley has sampled them.
Most people prefer to go ahead and take the wings off and the legs off, just because I don't know why they think maybe that's a little less creepy, but they're delicious.
Again, Paula Shrewsbury.
I've just eaten cicadas, and it kind of has this kind of nutty taste to it. They're very nutritious. Insects in general are very nutritious.
But their time above ground is short. After a massive adult die-off, the eggs hatch about 6 to 8 weeks later. The hatched nymphs drop to the ground and burrow beneath the dirt. They'll feed on the sap from tree roots for the next 13 to 17 years until it's time to rise again. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Women and young people are pivotal in maintaining international peace and security, according to the United Nations. Indeed, when gender equality is emphasized from a young age, peace and security interventions can help to prevent a new generation from replicating the same patterns and patriarchal power structures that limit gender equality. Similarly, initiatives benefiting young women can help create more equal and stable societies. The United States has long believed that when we lift up young people, we lift up women. And when we lift up women, we lift up young people. And when we lift up both, we empower entire communities. And that empowering these groups in their communities creates a more secure and a more peaceful world for us all, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield.
Unfortunately, we also know that right now young people, and especially young women, are disproportionately impacted by conflict. Violence disrupts their education and diminishes their job prospects, dashing their hopes for the future. It limits their access to civic spaces and squashes their economic potential.
Nonetheless, against fierce headwinds, we have seen young people all over the world mobilize to respond to these challenges and become the architects of their futures, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. We must do everything in our power to support and uplift these young people.
That is the driving ethos behind the United States strategy to prevent conflict and promote stability, which affirms our support for inclusive political processes to resolve ongoing violent conflicts with an emphasis on the meaningful participation of women and youth.
Incorporating diverse, intersectional, and critically intergenerational perspectives in peace and security processes isn't just the right thing to do. It is the only way to ensure that our solutions are inclusive, impactful, and lasting, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
These are not recommendations that are being forced on countries by outsiders, as you may have heard. These are recommendations that are being requested and asked for by the youth of these countries.
ultimately, sustainable peace and stability are only possible through inclusive decision-making processes, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. So it is incumbent upon us to work together to harness the limitless potential of women and young people, to work with them today and every day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.